I have literally been looking forward to this show tonight for 1 year. I can almost mark it on my calendar. It was just about a year ago that we had Joel Barker on the last time. Joel Barker is a well-known political trend watcher, somebody who is a futurist by profession, somebody who looks for the latest developments in technology. We've had Joel on a couple of times on Coast to Coast with me, where Joel has talked about some of the cash-creating opportunities that are coming down for not just the country, that could save us, technologies that could turn around our economy. Very interesting guy. And it was about a year ago, I think, when Joel came on, just after the beginning of the year last year. And he called me up and we had an interesting exchange about an article that he wanted to talk about in the year 2010. He said, can't do the show yet, but he said, in a year, I'd love to do a show about an article that appeared in the tech section of the New York Times Magazine, an article called A Catalog of the Near Future. And it was an article that it attempted to lay out what were going to be the technological gimmies of the year 2010, the advancements in sports, in medicine, in science, in our lifestyle, changes that were coming absolutely for sure. These are things that we would have, without a doubt, by the year 2010. This was written in the year 2000. And he had saved it all this time, from the year 2000 onward. So he gave me a copy of this New York Times Magazine back then. Joel and I got together just before Christmas of this year. Joel and I had lunch. We went over this article, and we're ready to go coming up tonight. Joel will be a little bit later on, and we'll talk about all of the things that for sure people said we would have. We'll talk about the ones we do have, the ones that are close, and the ones that I don't even know what they were thinking when they said that we would have this by the year 2010. I'm not even going to give you an example because I don't want to spoil it. But coming up next hour, we'll go through that. Plus, Joel has been doing what he does so well, and that's tracking trends and seeing some of the new things that are coming up on the horizon that we can expect by the year 2020. So he's going to stick his neck out, even as the writer did for this New York Times Magazine piece back in the year 2000, and he'll do it for the year 2020 coming up later on. And like I said, I've been looking forward to the show now for a year. It's hard for me too, because that means I've had to hold on to one article for 1 year and not throw it out, not get it on fire, not forget that I was supposed to do it, and then, you know, line the bottom of a drawer with it. And then I kept it right where I would remember where I kept it, which is in the trunk of my car. So I just ran out and got it just before the show started. Also, if you go to the blog at coasttocoastam.com, you'll see I put up a link. If you're looking for a way to donate for Haiti, there's information there on a charity I'm involved with. I know everybody's got a lot of good ones out there, but if you don't have one and you're looking for one, you can take a look online at coasttocoastam.com and click onto the blog icon. Also, did everybody see that super creepy story out of Russia about the sheep that was either born with or was photoshopped to have the face of a human? It's not for the faint, but it is pretty amazing. If it's true, it's pretty amazing. And it's Pravda, so how could it be wrong, you know? Anyway, if you haven't seen it, you can click onto the blog at coasttocoastam.com. I've got the link up for the picture of the sheep with a human face. All we can say for sure is that the sheep does look oddly at peace. That is not how I would describe the situation about terrorism this evening. Also on the blog tonight, I've put up the account of Kurt Haskell, who is a lawyer in Detroit, who is the man who said that he saw a sharp-dressed man, as has been described, helping the underwear bomber onto the plane, making sure that he got onto the plane, talking him onto the plane. We're going to let Kurt tell that story on his own coming up in just a second. He was standing by that testimony even when the FBI came by and shook his tree. And if you didn't see the story in his own account, and if you haven't wondered how it was that this guy got on the plane, if you are saying, you know, gosh, I remember hearing that story. Didn't the FBI disprove or didn't the FAA say that that didn't happen? Wait till you hear Kurt Haskell, because not only can you read his testimony on my blog right now, but he's coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So it's going to be a great show tonight. Joel Barker coming up next hour. That's going to rock. We'll get to your calls coming up for Kurt Haskell, too, a little bit later on this hour. It's a real pleasure to be able to talk with you, Kurt Haskell, and thank you so much for giving us some time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So I just want to lay down a couple of quick things. You're a lawyer in good standing in Detroit. You have no reputational issues. There's nobody that's alleging that you're making this up for money or that you tried to cash in on this by selling your picture to TMZ or anything like that, right?
That's right. I have not been paid anything by anyone. And I haven't asked for any money from anyone.
And that's the important thing. You never asked for it either. So
no.
And you've been telling this story as a good patriotic American, I think, from the very beginning. That's my impression, that you're trying to raise awareness, not raise your profile.
Exactly. Correct.
Okay.
My story has been the same since I got off the plane.
And so let's talk about the events as it happened on the flight. The Northwest Airlines flight 253, correct?
Correct.
As you tell it, tell me where were you coming from? You and your wife, where were you coming from? And how is it that you first believe you encountered the guy who the press calls the Christmas Day bomber, but I think everybody else still calls the underwear bomber?
Right. Well, my wife and I were on a safari in Uganda, and we were coming home. We flew to Kenya first and then to Amsterdam, and then we were on our last leg home from Amsterdam to Detroit. Go ahead.
Well, and why were you there? Why were you out there? What was the...
Oh, we were just on a safari vacation.
A safari vacation? I don't think so. That sounds fabulous. So what was it like getting on the flight flying back from Africa?
Flying back from Africa to Amsterdam?
Yeah. Uneventful?
It was just uneventful. Yeah, didn't think much of it. Just thinking of the long trip home. It's about 24 hours to get from there to Michigan. So that's about all I was thinking about.
And
very uneventful.
Did you deplane then when you got to, I hate that word, I can't believe I'm using it, but did you leave the plane when you got to Amsterdam?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we did, and changed planes. The plane we got on was the plane that arrived from Nigeria that Mutalab arrived on from Nigeria. We got onto his plane.
So that's
my understanding anyway.
Right. Now, the two things that you talked about, I found very interesting. You talked about having witnessed one person being pulled, the guy in the orange jumpsuit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Let's leave him aside for the moment. And the sharp-dressed man coming up, and these are two separate people, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Two people.
Now let's go back to the guy in the orange jumpsuit. You and your wife are doing what to kill the time between flights?
Well, I don't want to confuse you. The orange-dressed man came into play after we landed in Detroit.
Oh, thank you. Okay, good. So
sure.
let's leave him till after the flight.
Right.
All right. So you didn't see him before you took off.
No, I didn't see him on the plane either.
Okay, didn't see him on the plane either.
No, he just came into play after we landed for reasons I'll explain in a minute.
Okay, good. Now
the
let's go back.
The person that was important before we got on the plane to Detroit was the so-called sharp-dressed man. That was a phrase coined by MLive.com, not me, but it spread like wildfire over the internet, so I'll refer to him as the sharp-dressed man.
Well, is it accurate?
Yes, it is accurate. When I started telling the story, I said he looked wealthy or, you know, was well-dressed, and then from that became sharp-dressed man, but that's fine. What happened was my wife and I were waiting to board in the boarding area, Amsterdam, and there weren't two seats together anywhere. This was a crowded flight, and a lot of people had put their luggage on the seats there. So we sat on the floor, and we decided to sit by the final ticket agent, the one that checks your boarding passes right before you get on the plane. And so we could be there, you know, when we were ready to board, we'd be right there to be in the front. We were about 10 feet away, sitting on the floor playing cards.
Okay.
And I was just people watching, passing the time while we're playing cards, and I saw two men approach the ticket agent, and they caught my eye because they looked like an odd pair. And the one man I would describe as a poor-looking black teenager who I would later discover would try and blow up our plane, Mr. Mutalab.
Right.
And the other man was a wealthy-looking to me, he looked like he was from India, but maybe it was Pakistan or Bangladesh or some
right.
nation over there. I thought he was Indian.
And he you say like sharp-dressed man. What was he wearing? What was he wearing?
He had on a tan suit coat, and I don't believe he had a tie on. And he had a nice watch, and just looked like he was wealthy. You know, he had his clothes were nice. These weren't cheap clothes, so.
Hanging with a guy who looked like he could have been any kind of scruffy teenager. Not
right. He had on a white T-shirt, and I believe he had on some raggy jeans. So they looked like an odd pair, and the Indian man was around age 50. So I just watched them as they went up to the counter, and it was really quiet, so I could hear the whole conversation. And only the Indian man spoke to the ticket agent, and what he said was, this man... referring to Mutalab, this man needs to get on the plane, but he doesn't have a passport. And the ticket agent then responded, well, if he doesn't have a passport, he can't get on the plane. And then the Indian man said, well, he's from Sudan. We do this all the time. And the ticket agent then referred the two of them to a manager down a hallway, and they went down the hallway together to see this manager or supervisor.
Okay.
That's the point I quit watching. At the time, this meant absolutely nothing to me at all. It was a total non-event. It was just me watching people that I thought were odd together. So,
and you didn't turn to your wife and say, well, did you see that? I mean, right?
No, it was that much of a non-event to me. It meant
right.
absolutely nothing. You know, we had had, 8 years without a terrorist attack. And, you know, here I am sitting in Amsterdam. We had already traveled about 15 hours, and it was about 3 or 4 a.m. So, you know, I'm not real in a real talkative mood, and it didn't seem very important to me. And so, yeah, you're right. I didn't even mention it to her. That's how much of a non-event it was.
All right. So you get on the plane, and do you see the sharp-dressed man again? No.
No, I never saw him again.
Okay. And you did see Mutalab again?
Yes, but Mutalab, I didn't notice. Until he was being arrested on our plane.
Okay.
I did see the incident when he tried to blow up our plane. He was 8 rows in front of us. But
tell us what you saw as
okay,
8 rows behind.
Sure. Here's what happened. My wife and I were sitting in row 27. We had the two seats by the window on the right side of the plane, seats H and J. Mutalab was sitting in seat 19A, which was 8 rows ahead of us, and he had the left window seat, so we were at an angle to him, so we could see we had a pretty good view of his seating area. And what happened, we were 10 minutes from landing, the pilot just came on the loudspeaker, and he said, flight crew, take your seats, we're landing in 10 minutes. And a flight attendant then walked by a row, and she said, something smells like smoke, kind of mumbling to herself. And I had been looking at the monitor and the seat back in front of me at the flight conditions, and that got me to look up. And I could see smoke coming from row 19 to the left. I then got up, walked down the aisle a few steps, and when I did that, that area burst into flames. The floor, the two seats to the left of the left aisle, and the flames went up the wall to the base of the ceiling. While this is going on, Mutalab is being hauled away into the first class area by a couple passengers, but he's not fighting back. He's not doing anything really. So I didn't really pay a lot of attention to him because at the time I thought maybe he was just burned in a freak fire or something. I didn't know he was a terrorist because he wasn't
right.
fighting back. So I'm watching. To me, the more important thing was the fire to my left. So that's what I was watching. people were screaming, fire, fire. There were about five or six screams for water. One person yelled terrorist. And the pilot came back on the loudspeaker and he said two words, emergency landing. And the you could feel the plane speeding up. And
right. Well, that gets your heart going, doesn't it?
Yeah. And another flight attendant grabbed the fire extinguisher and ran over and put out the fire.
It was still burning at that point?
Yeah, and it wasn't long that it was burning, but you know, it was spreading fast.
Wow.
A flight attendant grabbed the fire extinguisher and put it out pretty quick as it was starting to spread. The whole thing was done in maybe a minute. It was really quick. Right. And then we were on the ground between 5 and 10 minutes later in Detroit.
The plane gets emergency treatment. You bank, you dive, you go right to the airport, and then everybody is immediately what? Then what happens? They get Mutalib off the plane.
Right. Well, you know, I'm expecting we're going to land, all the doors are going to open, chutes are going to come out, we're going to do an evacuation of the plane, you know, get off this plane, because who knows if the fire's burning below the floor, you know, or anywhere else, or there's an accomplice or a bomb or who knows what, but that didn't happen. Officers came on the plane. They only went in the first class area. They didn't check the rest of the plane for accomplices or bombs or anything. And they told everyone to just sit down. You're not getting off the plane. And we sat there for about
20 minutes. They never came down the aisles.
No, never came down the aisles at all.
They never asked for passports. They didn't look anything suspicious. They just went for him.
They did absolutely nothing except going to the first class area.
Now that, I mean, you're certainly not a security expert, but you're like any of the rest of us. You know that when 9/11 happened, each one of the planes had several accomplices on the plane. Just even going by past record, one would think it would have been good to shake down the plane to look for anybody else who is associated with this guy.
Exactly. And, you know, we had just seen our plane on fire in front of our eyes just 5 to 10 minutes before this, and they're not letting us off this plane. To me, it was just crazy.
That is weird. All right. Now, what was the rumor that was coming? Did you hear people in the row in front of you? Everybody, oh, did you hear what happened? It's a terrorist. Or, I mean, were you hearing murmurs of what had happened that you couldn't see?
No, not really. Anyone that was talking loud, they were telling to shut up. So,
interesting.
I didn't really hear much of anything. After about 20 minutes on the ground, the officers escorted Mr. Mutalib off the plane, and he was in handcuffs, and he stood in the left aisle at the back of the first class section for about 5 to 10 seconds, and that's when I got another good look at him, and I realized two things. One, that was the same man I saw in Amsterdam before we boarded. And two, he was handcuffed. So I realized it was a terrorist attack at that point and not a freak fire.
Okay. So then eventually they come to get you all off the plane, all the rest of you all, right?
Are there
police outside waiting as you each get off the plane to look at you or to check your name against the manifest or anything?
Oh, no, they did none of that at all. Well, we got off as if we were a normal flight, except we didn't go into the terminal directly. We went onto the runway. We just took steps down. But they let us all get our carry-on bags, which to me was another big mistake, because you have this very important crime scene that the police are letting, you know, get messed up by people taking their carry-on bags off. So we take our carry-on bags. We're escorted into an evacuated baggage claim area in a terminal. Stand along a wall.
No, let's leave that right there, only because they were coming up to the bottom. So that's a good place to stop. Again, Kurt Haskell, attorney in Detroit, telling us his testimony about what he witnessed on Flight 253 coming back from Amsterdam. Talk to us a little bit already about the sharp-dressed man talking, what appeared to be talking Mutalib onto the plane. And now we're getting back up to the part we started with, too, about the man in the orange jumpsuit. So we'll stand by for that. We're also going to take your calls because I know this story's been floating around. We've talked about it on Coast to Coast. And this is a chance for you to ask that question that has been bugging you about this story from the very beginning. And coming up, Kurt Haskell will also talk about getting a visit from the FBI and how he may or may not feel about a certain amount of intimidation for him to change his story or to be quiet. And we'll talk about that all coming up and taking your calls. Then next hour, Joel Barker, top of the hour, Joel Barker, futurist. We take a look at the year 2000 and what it saw in 2010, according to the New York Times Magazine. And what Joel says we will have for sure by the year 2020. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. We've talked about this story a lot, so it's nice to actually get down to cases with Kurt Haskell, the attorney in question, the guy who was flying back from Africa, took off from Nigeria, then from Amsterdam. And it was in Amsterdam, in between planes, where he saw the so-called sharp-dressed men. This bandy, he thought he looked Indian, maybe Pakistani, perhaps Bangladeshi, helping what we know later on to be the accused underwear bomber in the Christmas Day attack on Northwest Flight 253, get onto the plane, talking him onto the plane. And Kurt watched this because he's an observant guy and just thought it looked weird, having a guy that just looked affluent doing something to try to get this guy onto the plane. But that's part of the story that just keeps not getting confirmed by the authorities. In fact, they disconfirm it, and we'll talk about that with Kurt because he was telling us the story about what happened after they landed, too, which was nobody came on the plane. No air marshals, no security. They just left, and nobody checked to see whether there are any accomplices or anything. They had their guy, and that was it. And that's just when it begins to get weird. Coming up next, we'll also take your calls on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. So we'll get to some calls for Kurt Haskell coming up in just a second, and Joel Barker, then futurist at the top of the hour, looking ahead at what the next 10 years will likely bring, plus what we were supposed to have by the year 2010, which isn't happening. But Kurt was just telling us a story about how after their flight had an emergency landing, after they had secured the fire that had been started allegedly by the suspect, Mutalib, he was taken off the plane, and then everybody else was just left there. Nobody checked, nobody did anything until they start to leave the plane. And then after he left the plane, pick up the story there, if you would, Kurt.
Sure. We were taken into a baggage claim area that had been evacuated, and there was nobody around. There weren't any incoming flights around the area, nothing except law enforcement. We're told to stand along one wall of the area, and we have to stand there for about an hour all together. And, you know, after about an hour, bomb-sniffing dogs arrived, three of them. And one of them found something in the bag of who I call the man in orange. This is also an Indian man, but about 20 years younger than the sharp-dressed man. And he had on an orange. It was an orange shirt, not an orange jumpsuit. And the dog sat down after the dog sniffed his carry-on bag. The man was immediately taken away with his bag, not handcuffed at this time. He was taken into a room. We couldn't see in the room, but we could see the entry door to the room. He was in there for about an hour. He was then taken out. At this point, he was then handcuffed and taken away. At the same time he was being taken away, an officer came up to the rest of us and said, you're being moved to another area. It's not safe here. I'm sure you saw what just happened, and you can read between the lines on why you're being moved. We were then escorted out of this baggage claim area and taken to a long, narrow hallway where we would spend the next few hours.
Okay.
During this time, we weren't allowed to drink anything. We weren't allowed to eat. We weren't allowed to make any phone calls or texts. Much of the time, we weren't allowed to go to the bathroom. They did relax that rule later on and let us go to the bathroom with an FBI agent, one person at a time.
Still, at this point, the FBI has never come up to you and said, who are you? What were you doing in Africa? Can we check your underwear?
Nothing. No, and they didn't pat anybody down or search our bags or really anything.
It's just weird. That part's weird.
had weapons or, you know, who knows,
right.
another bomb in their
another
underwear,
bomb, a plan
bomb
B.
In their underwear or, right.
Right.
And a lot of these officers didn't even know we had a bomb on our plane. They were that poorly informed of the situation. There was a man that was standing by me talking to an officer, and he's the one that informed the officer that someone had a bomb on our plane. He didn't even know. It was such a chaotic mess. No, law enforcement had no idea who was in charge, what procedures were, or
Weird.
Anything. It
Weird.
Was just a disaster.
All right.
In my opinion.
So I'm sorry. So I stopped you for that. I just wanted to verify. Okay. And then sure. What happened?
Sure. So we're in this hallway, and one of my fellow passengers went up to an FBI agent and said, you know, there was a man that was videotaping this whole incident. He was either in row 31 or 32, seats A or B. He started taping right before Mutalab, or the terrorist, you know, lit his bomb, and he taped the whole thing with a camcorder. And all the FBI did was they said, does anyone have video of this? If so, you need to come forward and give us the video. And, of course, no one came forward.
Yeah.
And, they could have seized all our cameras at that
sure.
point. We're all there in this one hallway. They didn't do that. And, you know, I don't know if they ever got this video or not, but they certainly had the opportunity to have it for sure.
Right, right there.
Which could be important evidence. Right, and they didn't do it. After we were there about 3 hours in this hallway, so it'd be 4 hours total, the head FBI agent came up, and he said, we believe we have those responsible for this in custody. Notice I said those, plural,
right.
Not the man or him.
Right.
He made two other referrals to more than one person, and then he said, we're going to be doing quick interviews for each of you, and then you're going to be free to go. And then we were escorted back into this large baggage claim area. We did our interviews with the FBI, and then we were free to go after about six and a half hours.
And that was at that the point you said, you know, I want to tell you something I saw in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
I've been telling the same story all along, from the minute I got off the plane through every TV, radio,
right.
newspaper interview, all of them, I tell the exact same story.
And what did they say when you said to them, hey, I saw this guy, this, you know, mm-hmm. whatever, however you describe, sharp-dressed man, mm-hmm. helping Mutalab onto the plane. Did they register, oh, that's really important, tell us more about it?
They seemed to be very interested. There was one agent, okay. he called over another agent when I was telling the story to have him listen to it too, and they were both taking notes. So they seemed to be very interested in the story at that time. They took down our phone number and address and said, we'll be in touch with you if we need to be.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was just going to ask you, and what happened afterwards? You were about to say it.
After we left, they did stop by my office on December 29th, the attempted bombing was on Christmas Day, so this was
right.
4 days later. But during those 4 days, I had been speaking out all over the media.
Sure.
And there was starting to become some outrage about why the FBI hadn't been in contact with me again. And I felt the second visit was more out of an obligation to appease the public and really didn't really serve any other purpose. It was kind of the same thing I did when I was being held at the airport. The only difference was they brought a series of about 10 photographs that they showed me and asked me who I could identify and who I couldn't.
Could you identify any of those people?
Two of them were of Mutalab. Approximately seven of them I had never seen before. There were various Arabic looking people of all ages and varieties. I have no idea why they showed me these pictures at all.
Go ahead again. I'm sorry. There's a little delay in me hearing you, so I think you come to the end of the sentence, but then you're not. It's a technical thing. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. And there was one other one that I said, this kind of looks like the man in orange, the one you're refusing to admit exists. At this point, they were not admitting anything about this man in orange. So I said, it kind of looks like this man, the one you're refusing to admit exists, but I'm not sure if it's him or not. It kind of looks like him. They didn't really like that, but
and
I'm not sure if it was the man or not, but it kind of looked like him.
But you could, you know, if you're allowed one snarky comment, I think at this point. So you had, and I want to get a couple of calls here in just a second for you. Tell me, Kurt Haskell, I heard reported about you, and maybe you had posted something somewhere about it, that there was a sense of intimidation, like, you know what, stop with this story. It's already been proven not to be true. Shut up. At any point, did that ever happen?
No, I'm not really sure where you're hearing that from, because I've never said that to anyone. And
good.
The two visits I've had from the FBI were not like that at all. They're both good. Very professional.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. No, I had heard, you know, the FBI is in trying to intimidate this guy. And so I'd gotten emails about this and people claiming that they had.
No,
heard this,
so. The only thing that's been done has been that, you know, the investigators have come out and said they reviewed 200 hours of CCTV video, the surveillance video at the Amsterdam airport, and it shows nothing. So to me, that's a slap in my face, too, because I know it doesn't show nothing. It shows something. Now, whether it's exactly as I'm telling you or not, I would like to see the tape to verify it. I'm pretty sure it will show exactly what I'm saying.
Well, and that's what you posted on one of the, whether it was MLive or on your blog or website or whatever, I don't know, but I've seen it quoted, and I quoted it tonight on my blog, where you said, if they had a video that would have proven what you said to be untrue, they would have been showing it by now. Do you still believe that to be true?
Oh, absolutely. Not only that, but we had this incident, this minor incident in the Newark, New Jersey airport a few days after our incident, and that video was all over TV and the internet immediately.
Right.
Immediately.
Right.
To me, this is a much more important event, and possibly we'd have one of the most wanted men in the world on this video, and it's not being shown anywhere. Why not?
And if they can show Mutalib, or if they have the closed circuit camera showing what you confused to be something else, then show that and just show, oh, this is what he was thinking. This is wrong, but here's what he saw, and this is the problem, but they haven't produced that either.
Exactly. And I'm very, very confident that I'm right in this. And not only that, another passenger has contacted me and said she saw the same thing I did, but she's scared to come out publicly. So that makes me feel even more confident that I'm correct, that another person is verifying what I saw.
Julie is in New Hampshire, east of the Rockies, on Coast to Coast for Kurt Haskell. Go ahead, Julie.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I would like to, can I ask or speak with Kurt directly, or should I ask questions?
You're on the air right now with Kurt. Do you have a question?
Yes, I have a couple. I'll make it quick. Kurt, I have read your initial blog comments on that Chicago or website.
Detroit bound. Right.
Yeah, yes, thank you. And I also read your blog. I listened to your first interview on the InfoWars website within a few days after this. And I've listened to your other interviews. You have never changed your story.
That's right.
Never. And I have read all the different and changing and deleted and then replaced newsletters or bulletins that come out from the government. This happens often when things that happen cannot be explained away. Right. And many people have been ostracized and ridiculed for speaking out. You're a lawyer. And I think you'll have more believability than just some, Yahoo from wherever.
Right.
How do you think it has changed the way you view our media?
Okay.
And do you know about Sybil Edmonds, the former FBI translator? And do you know about the witnesses from the Oklahoma City bombing?
Okay, there's one at a time here. Julie, we have a lot of people that also want to get on the air with a question. But go ahead, Kurt, do you want to start? Where do you want to start?
Sure, just real quick. The spokesperson for U.S. Customs, Mr. Ron Smith, has been the one to come out and publicly make statements about the man in orange. His account has changed five times, each corresponding with me discrediting his most prior story. So I think that's what you're referring to there. As far as the sharp dressed man is concerned, the government has never made any statements regarding him at all, except a blanket denial that the video shows nothing. My story's always been the same.
Have you been treated fairly by the media?
Yes and no. You know, I've been contacted by the media all over the world, pretty much. Some of them have been more willing to air my story than others. Some of them just, for example, Dateline NBC did a story on the flight 253 passengers, and my wife and I were not in the episode at all, even though they came to our office on two different occasions to talk to us. So that's just one example. On the other hand, Fox TV, Fox National News Television, gave me a four-minute spot to respond to the president's speech on Flight 253 and told me I could say whatever I wanted live. So, you know, that you have the different varieties depending who you're talking to. The Wall Street Journal would not air our story at all. And then we have DrudgeReport.com, who had our story number one on their website for four straight days. So it runs the whole gamut.
Kevin is in Colorado Springs for Kurt Haskell on Coast to Coast. Kevin?
Good evening. No doubt you heard about the guy that this past week on the air transflight from Atlanta to San Francisco who was taken off the plane because he was in the bathroom for an hour. And one of our local TV stations reported that he had a razor blade when he came out of the bathroom with no shirt or shoes on. And since then, they have released this man. I heard on the news yesterday, they've released him on bond. And the only restriction is that he cannot fly.
Now, I heard this guy had mental issues, right?
Supposedly, but the first name was Muhammad. I can't remember his last name.
Yeah, I don't know his name, but there's a lot of I remember that story at the time, and they were out pretty early on. This guy had psychological issues. Family members came forward. There was a lot of traction for the fact that this guy was having some sort of episode, I thought, but unless I'm confusing my stories. But
well, and the other comment that I have, do you have anybody that from that plane that can independently confirm what the lawyer is saying?
Yeah, is there anybody else, Kurt, that is
as to which part of it?
He said anybody else on the plane. You said there was one other passenger that had reached out to you, but nobody else has stepped forward yet.
Here's what I can tell you. I've been in contact with several people on our flight. Some of them have come out publicly. Some of them have not. There was one person that verified my claim on the sharp-dressed man, and she's scared to come forward. In regards to the man in orange, several of my fellow passengers have come out publicly and verified my account. One of them, named Daniel Huizinga, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, was on Fox TV, and you can see the video on the internet where he verifies exactly what I said about the man in orange. And in regards to all the gaffes after we landed, anyone on our flight can back that up. I mean, there were so numerous. I think if you talk to any other passengers, they could back me up on that.
We have time for Scott in Evergreen Park, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, for one last quick question. Scott?
Mr. Haskell, good evening. Thanks for stepping forward. Any chance that the man in orange who had his bag sniffed by the dog and then was escorted out, any possibility that man was carrying drugs?
Well, these were bomb-sniffing dogs. They weren't drug dogs. They have separate dogs for that. So is there a chance? I suppose there would be a chance, but you have a bomb-sniffing dog indicating he found something, the man being taken away for questioning for about an hour. Then he's handcuffed after he's in this room for an hour, and then you have the simultaneous statement to the rest of us that the area you're in is not safe. You're being escorted to a new area. I'm sure you saw what just happened and can read between the lines. So
they make that connection for you.
I guess you have to take a look at all that together and make your own judgment call.
They're probably saying, you got to leave this area. There was pot in the bag. You know, I don't think that that's probably what they're worried about. But the point's taken. You know, what was it that was in that bag? What was the man in the orange jumpsuit involved with? Was it coincidentally involved in this, not involved with this? Is this a case of CYA where nobody wants to find out about the sharp-dressed man? Why don't they produce the videotape that shows that Mutallab went up to the counter by himself, just happened to be standing next to another guy? You know, whatever. There's so many ways that this could be worked out that aren't, that it makes us continually suspicious about that. And Kurt, your credibility remains strong. I look forward to hearing from you again. If you hear from the FBI again, we'd love to have you back on, and we'll continue to watch the story as you're involved. Okay.
Sure. I'd be glad to come on anytime.
Thank you for the, very sober and clear way of telling this story on Coast to Coast. You know, whether or not the writers of the New York Times Magazine in 2000 were sober is a question. I'm kind of kidding, but they made some predictions about 2010. Let's find out how many of them came true next with Joel Barker on Coast to Coast.